James Germain leading his choral group with Wangolo, which is considered the people of Haiti's national anthem. And there is a reason we're playing this today, because we're going to be talking about the assassination of the Prime Minister of Haiti. And what are we to make of that? And what are the further investigations and so forth leading up to that? But welcome. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. On Wednesday, the Prime Minister and his wife, Martine, the First Lady, were at their home, and out of nowhere came a small band of men, and they had murder on their minds. They assassinated the president, Jovenel Moïse, at his home, and his wife sustained injuries as well. She was shot and was transported to Miami for further care. It's a sad, sad day, and it's a sad event to have happened in Haiti, especially now, because so much is going on that is out of the hands, it looks like it, out of the hands of the country. But who is doing what and why? Why all this violence? And why the persistence of it? That's what we are going to be talking about today with my very good friend, Kim Ives, who is the editor, an editor with Haiti Liberté, and has been covering the country and the broader region as a whole for many years now, winning coveted awards and commendations for his work, including many very important documentaries. Thanks, Kim, for being with us, and welcome. Oh, I'm not hearing Kim. Okay, so he should be with us shortly. Hi, Kim, are you there?
Hi, sorry, Eutrice. Sorry.
Okay, good. Good to hear your voice.
Yes,
I was saying you've been in this milieu of Haiti and violence in Haiti for decades now.
Yes.
What was on your mind when this most recent atrocity occurred on Wednesday?
Well, I have to say, you knew something was going to give. It was clear that the situation had become so critical. We had a revolution which had begun in the shanty towns of Port-au-Prince. You had the bourgeoisie in rebellion against the president, with whom they had been very cordial and even happy. You had the international community wringing its hands about the fact that the president was ruling by decree for a year and a half and being more and more a cavalier in the decrees he was putting out, making Gestapo-like agencies, etc. And the economy of the country had ground to a halt. People were really hungry, tired, scared, even terrified of the violence and anarchy that was growing around them. And so something had to give. You didn't know where and when it was going to happen. But when commando of mercenaries apparently came and killed Jovenel Moïse in his home, you knew that the dam had started to break. And I think that's what we've seen now. Our working hypothesis at Haiti Liberté is that the bourgeoisie was probably behind this, because it was a very well-funded, well-orchestrated, well-planned operation. They had the layout of the presidential household. They had 9 new Nissan patrol vehicles. This might suggest that it was the well-known bourgeois family of Reginald Bulos, who owns the Nissan dealership in Port-au-Prince. The cars didn't have license plate, brand new cars with no license plates. Sounds like they came right off a Nissan dealership lot. Anyway, he claims he didn't do it and offered his condolences from overseas, where he's fled because he had an arrest warrant out against him. So a lot of things point to him having motive, and other families as well who had their sweetheart deals more or less broken with Jovenel Moïse, who was increasingly hemmed in.
You say this was building, but what do you think served as the straw that broke this camel's back?
Well, it might have been that arrest warrant against Reginald Bulos, if he was indeed one of the people behind it, or I think it may have been the developments the week before, where essentially there is a mass movement growing in Haiti's shanty towns. Haiti, 35 years ago, when Jean-Claude Duvalier fell, was mostly an agricultural, small peasant production country. But over this past 3 or 4 decades, the U.S. has implemented neoliberal policies which have driven the peasantry off the land and into the cities. So Haiti has grown, Port-au-Prince has grown from a city of about 500,000 to over 3 million people now. The government authority has winnowed down after coup by the United States in 1991 and 2004. And so in these vast shanty towns, you have leaders growing, trying to fend for their neighborhoods, and many of them turn to crime, kidnapping, and so forth. But also against them, there are what you call vigilance brigades. These are ones who are trying to stamp out kidnapping and crime and make their neighborhoods livable. And these groups form themselves into an alliance, which is now called, their full official name is the Revolutionary Forces of the G9 Family and Allies. Mess with one, you mess with all. And they are headed by a former policeman who used to fight the gangs called Jimmy Cherizier, nicknamed Barbecue, because his mother sold barbecue meat. She was a poor street vendor. And he is a very articulate spokesman for this sector. And they essentially announced a revolution last week and said to the bourgeoisie, we are going to go to your grocery stores, to your car dealerships, to your banks, and we are going to take what is ours. And so this was the straw that broke the camel's back, as you say. The bourgeoisie was panicked that they were suddenly going to be accosted by the angry masses of Port-au-Prince. So this is, I think, possibly what said to them, we have to get Jovenel out of the way because he is asleep at the wheel. He is a dead hand on the tiller of state. The president of any bourgeois society and any a neo-colony is supposed to represent the interests of the bourgeoisie, and he was not doing that. And so they took him out, And this is now opened the door to what we see the Washington Post today calling for foreign military intervention. Well, they're in a quandary there because the U.S. has all but declared war on China. And so when they go to the Security Council saying, hey, we want to send another force to oversee our neo-colony, Haiti, China is very likely to put the kibosh on that with their veto. So now they have to turn to the junior varsity, that is the Organization of American States, what Cuba calls Washington's Ministry of Colonial Affairs, and try to carry out an invasion similar to what the U.S. did in the Dominican Republic next door in 1965, where U.S. Marines went in to crush a nationalist rebellion by Camano against the neo-Trujillist dictatorship of Juan Balaguer, which they managed to do despite a very heroic and valiant resistance. So I think that's what we see shaping up, Yatrice, for Haiti is some sort of foreign military intervention fairly shortly. And I don't think the Haitian people are going to take it lying down. They are sick and tired. This will be the fourth after 1915, after 1994, after 2004. The Haitians are fed up with foreign military interventions. And to wind up, a case could be made that these interventions are precisely what has brought Haiti to where it is today, because it is the neoliberal policies that have destroyed the Haitian economy, swelled the cities with this vast lumpen proletariat. And furthermore, the introduction of this clown mafia that we've talked about on the show many times that was ruling Haiti since 2011, thanks to Hillary Clinton's intervention on their behalf. And they essentially have accelerated the race to this moment because they pilfered the money, the many, there were the $2 billion of Petrocaribe money that Venezuela provided Haiti. And so now the country is penniless, and this creates a terrible situation.
Had there been any indication on the part of Jovenel Moïse that he understood the danger, the precarious nature of his presidency, and that it would stoke a violent reaction among the people?
Well, it's very interesting you should ask that, because it's just this morning that I learned from one of my colleagues that he made a statement a few days ago that he was going to persist on his path of carrying out a referendum, that is a proposal to change the Constitution, that he was going to continue with his projects despite the many voices arrayed against him and even the dismay of the United States, who was basically the power backing him. And he said, I'm ready to die. If this is what it takes to change this country, I'm ready to die for it. So that means he was maybe somewhat aware in the back of his mind, in his subconscious, that situation could arrive. And, you know, the sources that I've spoken to in the international security sector in Haiti told me that they, too, felt that there was a good possibility, because the situation was so critical, that there would be some sort of coup against him. But they had been expecting it would come from his own security corps, what is called the USGPN, the Unité Spéciale pour la Garde Présidentielle Nationale, the special unit for guarding the presidential palace. And this unit is headed by a guy called Dmitry Erard. He was approached for a coup back in February by some Haitians, but he betrayed them. You know, he played along with them as if he was going along with the coup, but then they ended up arresting all those people. So a lot of people had been expecting that something could come from his own presidential security corps. But this was a group of apparently foreign. They were speaking Spanish and English and clearly had a lot of money. Maybe there were some Haitians involved. We don't know yet. As you may have mentioned in the setup, they had a standoff yesterday with at least six of them. Four were killed. Two were captured. So we're still waiting. In fact, I'm hoping this afternoon that I'll get some idea of the identity or at least the nationality of the two that are being held and surely interrogated. And hopefully shortly thereafter, we'll get some idea of who hired them and who is behind this.
Haiti has served as a historical example of a constant turnover in government and leadership because people rose up against the prevailing powers. Is this going to continue, or is there going to be some stasis for a while people figure out exactly what their government ought to be and do? And the government, in turn, understanding what the people want, will comply or agree to do it?
Well, I think, Eutrice, we are in a revolutionary situation. I think that the FRG9, as I'll use it for the acronym, for the Force Révolutionnaire Genève, the revolutionary forces of the G9, I think they are going to continue their fight. They are well-armed, very angry, and they are, I could say, in control of the streets of the capital in many cases. Yes, there is a battle going on between them and the gangs of the opposition who are facing them, who are also well-armed and quite ruthless. However, this all will be changed by the arrival of a peacekeeping force, quote-unquote, that is the Empire's army, which may be U.S. Marines, maybe it'll be the 82nd Airborne, maybe it'll be SEAL teams, we don't know. But generally, the way the past two interventions have happened, they come in with the U.S., French, and Canadian troops. They kind of buckle down the situation, take control of the shanty towns, et cetera, and then they pass off the occupation to the U.N., you know, whose soldiers from Sri Lanka and Pakistan and Uruguay and Philippines, they work for half the price that a U.S. soldier gets paid. So this is most likely the scenario we're going to see. And in the face of that foreign military occupation, I don't think these shanty towns are going to take it lying down. I don't think they're going to give up. And the Haitians and the bandits, you know, back in 1915, when the first U.S. Marine occupation happened, Eutrice, there were what they called the CACOs. The CACOs were actually bands of men who were considered bandits at that time. They were considered to be sort of roving criminals who could be hired. And Charlemagne Perrault, who was an ex-military officer who was basically indignant at the fact that some U.S. Marine came in and started to boss him around, he organized them into a fighting force. And they gave the U.S. Marines in those first few years of the U.S. occupation a real fight. And I think the same thing happened again in 1915. 94. And in 2004, in the, not so much 94, because Aristide came back on the shoulder of the troops, but mostly in 2004, when he was removed by those troops, when the shanty towns, above all of Cité Soleil, fought hard against the UN troops that were in the country. And, you know, eventually they had to come in and start to drop bombs out of helicopters and, you know, had a real war. Most of it was fought by the Brazilian troops that were brought in. So this is the situation I see on the horizon, Utrice. I think that, you know, the soldiers of these lumpen proletariat armies that have grown in Port-au-Prince and other cities as well, Cape Haitien has them as well, there's going to be a war. There's going to be a fight between them if, indeed, as I fully expect, the U.S. brings in either an OAS force or somehow a U.N. force to try to master the Haitian people again. But as I say, the Haitian people are getting sick of it, and these lumpen proletariat armies are getting better and better at their resistance.
Missing from the conversation so far has been the role of France and the role of Cuba. What do you hear?
Well, Cuba has issued a statement, as has France, basically condemning the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. I don't think there's any country which is going to applaud it. Even the Haitian people who didn't like Moïse are shocked that foreign mercenaries can come in and just gun down their president. It happened only twice before in Haitian history that the president has been executed while in office. That was in 1806, the founder of the nation, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, was killed in a coup by his lieutenants. And in 1915, President Sam was basically torn apart by a mob, enraged when he took refuge in a French embassy. So the fact that Jovenel was gunned down, apparently the coroner's report says he was shot 12 times, so he was riddled with bullets. You know, this shocks the conscience of anybody, but especially of a Haitian national who can see their president, as embattled as he was, be gunned down in cold blood like that. So I think that, you know, we're in a situation where people are going to continue to demand an answer. Who is behind this? Who carried this out? And they are looking for answers. We are too. We hope now this afternoon to get some kind of clarity on who at least what nation this was involved. Colombians are being cited a lot as being the nationality of the people who were captured, the two people who were captured. It's unclear. I don't know why the police are keeping it a secret so long. You know, we're following the situation closely to find out.
And what from Cuba?
Oh, yes. And from Cuba, yes. You know, Cuba, of course, is in a very difficult situation following the pandemic of the COVID-19 pandemic. Vaccines are about to be rolled out. One of them, as I'm sure many of your listeners have heard, is highly effective, apparently, 92%. And so they have, in many ways, had to really tighten up their whole economy because the tourism on which the economy was reliant basically was stopped to protect the population. So I think they're in a very, I won't say weakened, but a defensive state, and are worried that, you know, the U.S. Under Biden could move towards some adventure. Granted, Biden is maybe not as mercurial as Trump, but he has not reinstated the policies of Obama, which were one of openness and, you know, trying to establish bridges. So I think, you know, any kind of U.S. adventure in their neighbor is going to cause them great concern. Again, there are still Cuban doctors working in Haiti. We know in Grenada back in the 1980s that they ended up fighting with U.S. troops who invaded Grenada. So I think Cuba has reason to be very concerned, but I haven't heard any statements from them myself that express that concern. But I can only imagine they are somewhat apprehensive about yet another U.S.-directed military force being deployed in the country next door.
So it's a very tense time in the region, and specifically in Haiti. What is the reported condition of Martine Moïse, Jovenel's wife?
Martine Moïse, I have only heard this morning from my source that she is in stable but critical condition. So I don't know quite what that means. I thought if you were critical, you couldn't be stable, but maybe they have her on some sort of ICU. That's all I know, is stable but critical. You know, there were reports yesterday that she had died. So I guess the wounds that she it appears that the wounds that she received were quite severe. So, but the fact that she was medevaced to Florida means that, you know, maybe they're going to have to do some operations or something to stabilize her. In any case, that's the only information I have. And one other thing I'd like to say about that, though, is that I think the fact that they shot her, probably indicates that they worried that she could stand in for him in some way at a later time, that, you know, she would be sort of a proxy, similar to what we've seen in Argentina in the past or other countries where the wife of the president goes on to become the standard bearer. So to some extent, I think the fact that she was wounded may indicate that they were worried about the political role she could play in the future.
I know you have 500 things to tend to in, editorially in this moment, but could you give us a sense of, you already told us what you think is the general climate, but do you think that there is something more happening that perhaps is not being reported in terms of how people are receiving this, the news of this assassination and attempted assassination of Jovenel's wife, but also what does it reflect about the region as a whole and its relationship to Haiti?
Well, it's for sure that the U.S. In particular is going to use the fact that many Haitians are going to take to boats to try to flee the turmoil that is ongoing in the country. Just this past week, I think a boat of 43 people was intercepted off of Turks and Caicos. There are going to be other boats heading in all directions. The Dominican Republic has closed its border, and there usually is a constant stream of Haitian merchants and workers that flow back and forth across that border at the three passage points in the north, the Central Plateau, and the south. And there are also many other passage points of in between that are unofficial. But for sure, they're going to say, oh, this represents a regional threat, an international threat, because, you know, these Haitian refugees are essentially going to create instability in other countries, which is untrue, absolutely untrue. The Haitians simply go to work or you know, set up a life in other countries, but they don't bring any instability with them. However, this is the picture portrayed, the picture put out, and this is what they're going to try to use to justify the foreign military intervention that they're going to try to concoct, as we saw in the Washington Post today, saying, you know, this is going to cause regional instability. No, this is an internal problem which the Haitians can solve themselves if allowed to, but, you know, constantly having the U.S. intervene. I mean, I saw an interesting tweet this morning by the Public Archive saying, you know, they just had an insurrection in Washington and on January 6th. They didn't see any countries calling for foreign military intervention. You know, yeah, let countries figure it out. Let them go through their process to find a solution which is self-determined and not have the U.S. use symptoms of the very instability they've provoked as an excuse for more intervention. So, yes, your listeners should be prepared to hear lots of pundits talking about, oh my goodness, the poor Haitians. One, either we have to save them because they poor devils can't figure out how to rule themselves, or two, their refugees are a great threat to the stability of the rest of the region. And both statements are completely and utterly false. You know, the fact of the matter is the U.S. has now for a century, since 1915, been meddling, sabotaging, bullying, messing in Haitian affairs. And the result is the very enfeebled state that we see Haiti in today. And the solution to that is to stop that meddling, to stop that intervention, to stop doing that and let the Haitian experiment that began in 1804 as the first free nation, we can say, of the world, if in a sense, because the United States was a slaveocracy when it was founded in 1776. But in 1804, that was a revolution of self-freed slaves. So it was the first truly free nation. But ever since its inception, it has been dogged by that slaveocracy to the north. So let the people figure it out. Let the revolution that the shanty towns of Port-au-Prince have launched run its course. Let the Haitian people determine their own history and stop coming in with your foreign military forces and mercenaries to try to make Haiti to your liking. It is not your neo-colony, as much as you are trying to make it. It is a sovereign nation.
Well, I know you have 500 things to get done in the next half hour or so. And I want to thank you so much for giving us the benefit of your time. And putting in my subtle request, I said the word subtle, that we do this again very soon, and we can depend on you for an update as to where things are happening, where things are going, and what is happening in Haiti. But I thank you so much for this very informative briefing. It couldn't be anything else coming from you, but informative. Thanks so much, Kim. I really appreciate your input today.
Well, thank you, Yatrice. It's always an honor to speak on the show of the queen of alternative media.
The queen. Oh, my God.
Okay. Well, okay. Let's say the first lady, then.
Oh, Lord. As we just heard, first ladies tend to get shot.
Oh, yes. There you go. Okay. Let's not have that.
We don't want that. We don't want that. But thank you so much for your time today. I know you did the interview under the gun, but all the more appreciative of the fact that you made your own sacrifice in order to get us an understanding of what is happening. Thanks again.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry for being a little late. Okay. Thank you.
No problem. Here we go. We'll take a little break and come back to your thoughts right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We just got an excellent briefing from our kindred spirit. His name is Kim Ives. He's been in journalism for decades now, producing written and documentaries, written work and documentaries about the region in particular, but very much concentrating on Haiti all that time. And speaking on a personal note, I know of very few reporters who are as thoroughly familiar with what's going on in Haiti than Kim Ives. And he has dedicated his life, sometimes put on the line, for his work. And in times like these, we should remember that it isn't always, you know, peaches and cream. People put their lives on the line for the work that they do as journalists, but the work that they do as journalists is so important, even to them, that they don't even hesitate. Duty calls, they respond. You can call 888-874-4888 and express your views about what we've discussed so far as happening in Haiti and what you think is going to happen very soon, because this is moving very, very fast. And as we know, we have reason to believe in precedent. When these things begin to happen, all other things are affected, and the administration may not be verbal about it, but will show its position in terms of, quote, policy, unquote. But we will see. We will see what's going on. Just know that the situation is very precarious, and as Kim pointed out, it's likely to go in any direction. We don't know. All we do know is that it is at a touchstone point, and anything could happen. Ed from Queens, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, Trees. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Ed. Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to thank you for letting Mr. Ives speak. I mean, I remember on another radio station when he used to have a program that really enlightened people about what was going on in Haiti. And he's been an active, responsible journalist as far as Haiti is concerned for many years. And I appreciate you putting him on and bringing some clarity to this situation. Basically, I don't know when the American people are going to get up and just tell American politicians to stay out of Haiti's business. I mean, they've been paying the price for hundreds of years for being the first free black republic, the like you said, the first real free government in the Western Hemisphere. And they've had to pay a price. I've never heard of a country that won a war and had to pay reparations to the country that they beat, i.e. France. So, I mean, I'm just sick of it. It's really gotten to a point to where people in this country need to rise up and just tell America, stay out of it. Get your nose out of it. Let the people sort it out. I mean, there's also a situation with children over there as far as orphan children. And there are thousands of them hungry and starving in the streets. This is a travesty. And as an African-American, you know, personally, I'm disgusted by it. And if there's anything that I can do, anything that any person I can reach out to, I remember Professor Ron Daniels has some, I've worked with him prior to the conditions in Haiti, and just anything, you know, anything that we can do, because this is ridiculous.
Thank you. I agree. And it is also, as I say, a time of crisis. Also brings us to a time of opportunity to do something. And let's see what we can do and do it to help this nation. It is patently wrong and unfair and unjust that it has for all these many years been made to suffer because it broke the cardinal rule, which is it chose to govern itself. You know, people say, well, look what they're doing. They always have a crisis. Hello? Look to Congress and then repeat that comment to me. So we really have to step up to the plate and place ourselves in service of the greater good. Thanks, Ed, for getting us started today. Ali from New York, you're on the air at 888-874-4888.
Hi, Utrecht. How are you doing? And I just wanted to say hello to all your audience. And I don't know if you have a question today, but I do, because I didn't listen to the whole program, but I do wanted to say something about the situation in Haiti. The first thing that I had to say is that when the Venezuelans and even the Bolivia and sometimes the Cubans, they talk about, especially Venezuelans, they talk about the Boliviana revolution. They always make reference to the Haitian revolution. It's almost like when they saw the Haiti liberated themselves, they thought about themselves, and this is why the Bolivarian revolution happened. It's almost like a reference all the time. That's the first thing that I have to say. The second thing that I have to say is that I do believe what Kim I said this time. The economic situation in Haiti is worse than ever before, ever. And you know that this, because of COVID-19, the economic situation around, especially Latin American, it had affected all the countries in Latin America, Caribbean, the Central, South American, worse than any other place in the world. So, and Haiti, this COVID-19 really, really had affected them. People are very, very hungry, no food. When people had an empty belly for a very long time, you know that you say enough is enough. I don't think the Haitians this time, if the United States, the Canadian, and the French, they come with the military, I don't think the Haitian this time going to sit down and take it. It's about time that the Haitians, they act how they did before and get all these people out of the country. All these NGOs that they have made their life miserable. Misery is the name of the game in that country. It's about time that also all the country, especially in the Caribbean, help them out because they need to get these people out of their nation. And it doesn't matter black, white, or yellow. All these countries in Latin America, they have to support Haiti to get these people out of the country. And United States should not go there. And if they do, the Haitian, they should do something to them, because it's about time that they liberate themselves from these people that they don't have the best interest about these people, especially helping out the French and helping out the Canadian. This is what I have to say today. And the last thing is, I know that the Haitians are looking how people in Chile and in Colombia, they are sacrificing themselves. These young people, especially in Colombia, they say enough is enough. This neoliberal system that they have implemented all over this hemisphere, we are sick of it. And it's coming here, and I'm going to see how these people in this nation, they're going to react. Because it's coming, and it's coming soon. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. We still have some time for a couple more calls at 888-874-4888. As you can tell, the situation is very precarious and about to get worse, because all of the bigger nations, under the guise that they're trying to help fix things, they're also, of course, carrying out their own objectives, and those objectives take precedence over any help that they are likely to offer. So it comes with a lot of baggage. And increasingly, Haitians are saying, thanks for your offer of help, but we pass on it. It's a very precarious time for Haiti. It always is. It always has been. Haiti has, for some reason, withstood the test of times, and just about every major power in the world has tested it to see how they could put their hands on this country and recreate it to their liking, make better use, as they would put it, of Haiti's natural resources, which are quite considerable, but not particularly interested in elevating people's standard of living, and certainly not interested in the issue of justice. Historically, that's been proven, and it continues. It continues. 888-874-4888. I don't want the few minutes that we have available to go to waste. If you have something important to say, this would be the time to do it. There are a couple of minutes still left in the program, and I'd like to turn them over to you. Let's hear what you are thinking about the program today and what you're learning and what you are considering doing in the form of helping things get better. 888-874-4888. Do you think, when it comes to Haiti, people are exaggerating things just to make the big guys look bad? There are people who actually believe that. Randy from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Peace and blessings to you and the listening audience.
Thank you.
A couple of comments. One, it's been a little while since I last spoke with you. And the last time we spoke, we talked about the fact that the listening audience and those of goodwill need to begin to deal with things at an economic level in terms of their finances, of how they spend their money. Now, the issue with Haiti is that, and I take all, and I offer this humbly with respect to what Ed was saying, Ed from Jamaica. I don't think that people are going to rise up, because if they were really concerned about Haiti, they rose up when Aristide was taken out of office after he was elected the first time, and they took him and they brought him to Africa to dispose him. So the fact that we should be waiting for people to rise up, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. As far as what I think can happen is that, as the sister just spoke, she said that we have to begin to institute a policy to get rid of the NGOs out of the organization, out of Haiti, to let them govern themselves. But more importantly, they need to begin to not just extricate themselves from these foreign organizations. Look at what happened when they had the earthquake in Haiti, and they had all these other organizations come in, the Clinton Foundation, and they didn't do anything except posture themselves as being to help. But then they didn't help, and they didn't do anything except exploit the situation. It's almost like disaster capitalism. So, you know what? I don't know if relying on others to come in and step in and help out is going to be the answer. And as far as as far as people of goodwill in this country, if we didn't speak up when Aristide was taken out of office and we didn't make a clamor about that and hold the institutions here, the political institutions, the government, the United States, and the foreign policy with respect to Haiti, if we didn't hold them accountable, it's unlikely that they're going to do anything else to, assist Haiti at this point, especially, with this particular event that you just had your program focus on. So I think that, yes, it's going to require the patient people to step up. But who in Haiti is going to be able to do that? That's not accountable. That's not being held to some sort of obligation to the IMF and the bankers and, the foreign institutions that have been able to form a foothold in that country. So this is a case study in terms of how you begin to shed this colonialistic yoke off of these people so they can become independent, really independent, and do what is necessary to take care of the masses of people who are starving and who need the ability to gain employment and to really build an infrastructure in that of that country, to rebuild it so that it can maintain its needs. So
we'll have to leave it there for today because we're out of time. But I want to thank you, Randy, for calling in and contributing that for our consideration. Thank you all for calling, and thank you all the more for listening so that things begin to percolate in your head. And hopefully with that percolation, you get some ideas of ways in which you think you can be useful in this situation. Thanks so much. Let's talk again tomorrow. Bye-bye.